You're listening to the Economics Review Podcast with your host, Adi Golcha. From Congress to Wall Street and finance to philosophy, tune into the Economics Review to hear from world-leading experts on current events and cutting-edge research. Make sure to subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello and welcome back to the Economics Review. Our guest today is a managing director and global head of G10 FX options trading at Goldman Sachs, where he previously served as global head of FX exotics and correlation options trading. Prior to this, he was an FX volatility portfolio manager at PIMCO and worked as a vanilla and exotic FX options trader at Barclays Investment Bank in London. Holding a PhD in financial mathematics and economics from Imperial College London, his latest book is Foreign Exchange, Practical Asset Pricing and Macroeconomic Theory. It's my great pleasure to welcome to the show Dr. Adam Iqbal. Thank you so much for joining us.
Hi, pleasure to be here. Thank you for having me.
So I wanted to start off by asking you to tell us a bit about your background and how you got into FX options trading.
Yeah, sure. I actually started as a undergraduate in physics at the University of Cambridge. And I'd say that back at that time, I really wasn't interested in options trading in economics or in finance. At the time, I was really more interested in the kind of big questions around, you know, the nature of the universe and all these topics in physics, like, relativity and quantum mechanics and so on. And I really felt that those questions were the sort of bigger and more important questions to be answering. But then over time, I sort of mellowed, I'd say, from that slightly extreme starting position. And I did explore other careers and other areas, I ended up still concluding that actually, you know, a professional career in the city probably wasn't going to be for me, and that I wanted to try and pursue something in academia. And I realized that to do so, I needed to get a little bit better at maths. And so I went off to the University of Oxford to do a master's in applied mathematics. And it was really serendipity. When I was there, I met a couple of people in the class who were really into financial mathematics, which is essentially, you know, the application of stochastic calculus to price derivative securities. Now, at this point, I didn't even know what a derivative was. My perception of the city was kind of accountancy firms and actuarial firms and similar. But I'd say that their infectious enthusiasm for this topic around derivatives convinced me to drop in on the courses. And when I did, I was instantly hooked. Now, I didn't know back then that this topic would go on to become my career, a lifelong passion, and of course, the topic of my first book, Volatility, Practical Options Theory, which I published in around 2018. But at the time, I was mainly interested in the topic from the perspective of scientific inquiry. What made it different was that, you know, in science, you might have a system, right? And you might write down some sort of model for how that system is going to behave. In here, in this topic, you have this system, which we would call a portfolio. But the key difference is that, you know, you have this system and or this portfolio that contains a derivative contract, and that derivative contract is typically written on a stochastic underlying, right? That could be a foreign exchange rate or an equity price or an interest rate or a commodity price, and it therefore has a random payoff at some time in the future. But the key difference here is that, you know, instead of just leaving the system alone, the human or the trader constantly interferes with the system in a process that we call dynamic delta hedging, right? And what that means is that the trader executes trades in the underlying security, and each of those trades have a random payoff. And the derivative, of course, has a random payoff, but somehow the aggregation of all of this randomness actually ends up being certainty, right? And that is a really interesting concept. So now let's just take that argument a little bit further. Let's suppose that you end up with a certain payoff of, say, minus $1 million. You then know that if you charge $1 million to enter into this derivative contract at the start, you know that must be the fair value of that contract, because your payoff will be zero with certainty, right? And so that is the famous, the seminal Black-Scholes-Merton model,
Okay. So I think for many of us, when we hear about FX or stock options, we tend to automatically associate this with the Instagram or the YouTube gurus telling us how we too can live the Lamborghini lifestyle.
And it is a complicated concept.
Yeah. Like you said, it's obviously a lot more complicated than a few simple tricks to get rich quick. So for our audience that isn't really familiar, can you give us a bit of an intro into what FX options trading really is? Talking a bit more broadly about, how options work, how they sort of apply to the foreign exchange market and some of how the traders in the space work, not necessarily at Goldman or any of the places you've worked specifically, but just a bit more broadly.
Yeah, sure. So, the way that one should think about it is that, there are several uses for options, right? I think most commonly, and in a sort of 101 course, one might learn about how you might have a call option, which would be a way to bet on the underlying asset, whether that's an equity price, whether it's an FX rate or an interest rate or a commodity price. You might use that to bet that this underlying is going to go up. And you might use a put option to bet that this underlying is going to go down. Right. Another way that people might describe options is a way to gain leverage. Right. It's a contract that might have quite a low price that could potentially have quite a large payoff. But the way that I describe in volatility practical options theory in my book, the raison d'être for options is really that they provide you with exposure to volatility, right? Because there are already other instruments that you can use to bet on whether the underlying is going to go up or down, right? You can just buy the underlying spot or you can sell the underlying spot. You can gain leverage through other instruments like forwards or futures. But what options do is they give you these nonlinear payoffs that ultimately give you exposure to the volatility of the underlying asset. Now, the way that I describe it in the book is that if you imagine a very simple payoff structure, right? Let's say, the underlying currency is trading at, say, 1.0. It could be an FX rate. And you buy a 1.0 strike call option, and you also buy a 1.0 strike put option, then if you imagine that what the payoff structure would look like of that, it would be a V-shaped symmetrical payoff profile. And you can see clearly that actually when you have that kind of payoff structure, you actually don't care which direction the underlying moves in, because it's a V shape, it's symmetric. If it goes up, you make money. If it goes down, you make money. But what you care about is that it moves enough, right? Because of this V-shaped payoff structure, you want this underlying spot rate to move a lot in either direction. It can move up or it can move down. But the key is that it moves a lot, right? And if it doesn't move very much, then you probably won't get back enough money as a payoff to pay for what you pay to enter into the structure in the first place. So I explain this in a lot more detail in the book, but I think the key takeaway is that options are primarily, and above everything else, they're bets on the volatility that the underlying security will have.
And so what would you say is like the degree to which we can estimate, this sort of thing? Obviously, there's quite a bit of mathematics that goes into this and modeling. And I think you go into that in the book as well. But what would you classify this as sort of, as something that we can predict and reasonably be sure that if done right, it will inevitably make money over time? Or is this, it could go either way sort of thing?
Yeah, I think there are many volatility forecasting models, right? And one of the most famous ones is the Garch model, which many people who, anyone I'd say who did an econometrics course would have come across, and many people would have come across that in other areas as well. But I think ultimately, the reason that options exist is because volatility is itself unpredictable. If you think about the opposite case, if you imagine that volatility was predictable and volatility was known, then options actually would not be interesting instruments at all. And at the start of this discussion, I spoke a little bit about the Black-Scholes and Merton model, that seminal model. What that model does is it assumes that you can predict what volatility will be, and therefore it tells you how to delta hedge or dynamically replicate options such that the contracts themselves become redundant. What actually makes options interesting is that they allow us to disagree on whether volatility will be high or volatility will be low. The seller of an option contract obviously thinks that volatility will be lower than what that contract implies, and the buyer thinks that volatility will be higher than what it implies. And, you know, like you say, it definitely could go either way, right? You know, if you think about what happened just this year itself, right? We started coming into this year in a, you know, in an environment where we thought that growth will be relatively strong and markets might be relatively calm. And what we've ended up is having this unexpected war that is going on in Europe at the time that we speak, and that has caused volatility to rise. Now, that is not something that would have been known ahead of time. Perhaps those who were worried about this war taking place might have been more inclined to be long options. And those who were less worried about this might have been inclined to be short options. But, you know, the result is really whether volatility is high or whether volatility is low is to some degree predictable. We can say some things about what might happen in the world in the next month or the next 2 months. But then there are a lot of things that can happen in the world that are not predictable at all, these sort of unknown unknowns. And options are really the instrument to be able to kind of capture that and to trade that risk.
So obviously with options, an options contract, you're betting with another investor. And obviously one of you has to lose this bet and the other one has to win. And so assuming that the person on the other end of the options contract is also a professional trader, how is it possible then that two people that are using the same mathematical models or the same same formulas to come to differing conclusions about which one to purchase, are there sort of like differing strategies in this space which could lead to that sort of thing? I'm just trying to understand how two professional investors could come to such different conclusions about a bet that only one of them is going to win.
Yeah, I mean, I think that the key point that you're making is that options are contracts that are in zero net supply, right? Because, you know, for every long position, there is a short position in an options contract. You know, they are securities that are created in some sense. But it's really no different to, you know, I'd say that the central point that you make is really no different to any trade, right? If I sell a stock, someone else buys a stock, presumably that person thinks the stock's going up and I think the stock's not going up, right? And you know, you can make that argument for many other securities. And similarly with an options contract, you know, if I sell the option and you buy the option, presumably you think that the volatility that it is going to be realized is higher than where I think the volatility is going to be realized. And so, you know, we might have differing views on the economy. We might have differing worldviews. We might have, different risks in our various portfolios that we might be using options to hedge. And so we might trade for those reasons. But ultimately, options trade just like anything else trades. We always trade when we disagree to some extent.
Right. So next, I wanted to talk to you about risk premiums, which for those of you who are unfamiliar, is essentially just a higher return that's expected by an investor to compensate for an increased level of risk as compared to a risk-free asset. So can you tell us a bit more about how risks and returns play into FX options trading and give us a bit more of an insight into some of how this concept of risk premiums plays into how FX traders operate?
Yeah, sure. So, risk premiums are a central topic in my new book, Foreign Exchange, Practical Asset Pricing and Macroeconomic Theory. Risk premiums enter, you mentioned risk premiums in option prices, but risk premiums are actually a part of all asset prices, whether that is the FX spot prices, forward prices, the equity prices, interest rates, risk premiums have long been established in a lot of academic writing as perhaps the dominant and in my view, the dominant component of asset price movements. I think the easiest way to understand the concept is perhaps through an example. And we could do a little example. So let's play a little game, right? And to try and understand the concept of a risk premium. So let's say that we're going to just abstract away from markets for a second, and maybe then return to markets and talk about how the risk premium enters market prices. But let's do a little game. So let's say that we have a bet, right? And we're going to have a bet, and that bet is going to be on the toss of a coin, right? And if that coin turns out to be heads, then you give me an umbrella, right? And if that coin turns out to be tails, I'll give you an umbrella, right? So that bet, you agree, sounds fair, right? It's just random. I might win an umbrella from you, or you might win an umbrella from me. Okay, now let's try and change that bet slightly, right? So we say, okay, I turn on the radio, and the presenter on the radio says, okay, well, look, there's a 50% chance that tomorrow it's going to rain, and there's a 50% chance that tomorrow it's going to be sunny, right? And so I say, okay, well, I know, Adi, you like to bet umbrellas at 50-50 odds with me. So if it rains, you give me an umbrella, and if it's sunny, I'll give you an umbrella, right? Now, all of a sudden, that bet, you don't like that bet so much. That doesn't sound very fair. But what's the actual difference? The odds of, the odds of the bet are exactly the same. They're still 50-50. But what you don't like about that bet is the correlation between the payoff of the bet and the state of the world. You don't want to be short an umbrella when it's raining, right? So what can we do? Like, we can't do that bet anymore. But the way that we can do the bet is if I try and sweeten that deal for you a little bit, right? So if I change it so that, okay, if it rains, you give me an umbrella, but if it's sunny, I'm going to give you two umbrellas, perhaps. Now, that bet, you might now take it, right? Because, okay, well, if it rains, you're going to be unhappy, you're going to lose an umbrella. But if it's sunny, you're going to get double the payoff, you're going to get two umbrellas. And that is going to, you can save those umbrellas. You can use one on a future rainy day. You might be able to trade one for something else and so on. And you get, but, at least you're compensated for this bad correlation you have between the payoff of your bet and the state of the world, right? So now if you come and inspect this bet and you say, well, what's happening here? Well, you say that, okay, well, I know that the objective probability of rain is 50%. But when I look at the rate, the market implied rate at which you and I are trading these umbrellas, well, that implies the probability of rain of 66%, right? Because it's two umbrellas to one umbrella, right? And so that is what we would call the risk premium, right? We would say that the market price of the asset, i.e. this bet that you and I are doing, implies a much greater probability of something bad happening in the world, i.e. rain happening in the world, than what is actually true. Right. And so this bet is trading at a discount, and that discount is what we would call the risk premium. Now, the way that this works in markets, let's go back to markets, is that, if you think about equity prices, well, equity prices, essentially, they price in a world that is, worse than what we actually think it's going to be. That is what we would call the equity risk premium. So equities trade at a discount to where they would be if you were to price in the objective probabilities for how the world is going to end up. And the way that it applies to currencies is that there are certain currencies that we know go down in bad periods, in recessions, in pandemics, in global financial crises. In the G10 world, that would be things like the Aussie, the Kiwi, Canada, Norway, Sweden, sterling. And then there are other currencies which we think strengthen in those, typically in those states of the world, things like the yen, the dollar, the Swiss, to a lesser extent, the euro. Right. And so what we do is we price those safe haven currencies at a premium, and we price the more risky currencies, the ones that go down in bad states of the world, we price those at a discount. And that is the risk premium. Now, in the book, I explain the concept of a risk premium in much more detail. I talk about its microeconomic origins. It originates from investors kind of optimizing their portfolios, maximizing their utility functions across different states of the world. And I talk about the origins of where that concept comes from. But essentially, you can get from these examples the kind of intuition behind the risk premium, how it plays into asset prices. And again, I kind of repeat that initial mantra that I started with, which is that the risk premium is arguably the dominant component of asset price movements over time.
So is it like for example, just trying to relate that umbrella example to the real world, with the forecaster who's telling us that the probability of rain tomorrow is 50%. You know, we have an objective probability that, you know, it may or may not, you know, actually be 50%. That's just sort of a prediction or something. So when we come back to markets, for example, with equity or currencies, do we sort of have this objective probability? Is that always going to be accurate? Is that something that we're able to calculate, or is that just some sort of prediction as well?
Yeah, so I think that so it's a very good point. In real markets, we may disagree over both the objective probability of an event, right, as well as the kind of the degree of risk premium that an asset price should contain. Now, there are occasions where you do have perhaps some sort of objective probability that is available, but a lot of the time, it's not available. But I think the key point with that example is that it illustrates to you that even if you do know the objective probability, you still end up trading the bet at an implied probability that differs from that objective probability, right? And so that is the key argument that I would make around the risk premium.
Okay, I did just want to get a more general overview of your book as well. So we talked about risk premiums. I understand there's quite a bit more in there. So before we really get into the content, can you give us a bit more of a general overview of what how you came to write this book and what you sort of intended it for?
Yeah, absolutely. So I think one thing that you find when you come into markets is that, you know, people at Goldman and at other banks come from all sorts of backgrounds, right? We have people from sort of physics and engineering and mathematics, from history and English and, law and of course, people from economics backgrounds, right? And people come and enter the industry. They are sort of thrown in to the deep end, right? And you kind of learn economics on the fly, right? And so what I wanted to do was to write a book that puts all of the really important concepts that are related to foreign exchange and to list them. They are the risk premium, right, which we spoke about already. They are interest rates. They are inflation. They are real interest rates. They are, balance of payments accounts. They are forward curves. They are FX options. And there are several others as well. But what I really wanted to do was to write a book that put all of these important concepts into one place and also put them all into one coherent model that includes all of those features. Right. Now, I think when you think about the landscape of books on international economics and foreign exchange, there are some great books out there. But I'd say that most of them, and most of them cover concepts like, purchasing power parity and current interest rate parity and rate. And then there are another set of books on markets out there that talk about risk premiums, but most of those books really focus on equities. And so foreign exchange, practical asset pricing theory, and macroeconomic theory, I think, is one of the few, and to my knowledge, I think the only one that really tries to put all of these concepts, inflation, interest rates, covered interest rate parity, uncovered interest rate parity, PPP, the risk premium, and the balance of payments, put all of these concepts into one central, coherent place that hopefully should be accessible to market practitioners, to those who are interested in international economics and foreign exchange, to students in the area, and to academics as well.
Right. So just a quote from the preface of the book. One of the great challenges that many participants in foreign exchange markets face is sifting through the often overwhelming amount of information that's available. Media outlets stream updates on international politics, economics, and other factors that move FX prices 24 hours a day. It is difficult to work out what is and what is not important. This book helps its readers overcome these challenges by combining the insights gained from a market practitioner who has traded FX at Goldman Sachs, PIMCO, and Barclays Investment Bank with textbook level modern financial macroeconomic theory. So Dr. Iqbal, what would you say is sort of that single biggest takeaway from the book that's unique from the existing canon of FX trading books? I think you touched on that a little bit about how it really puts all these things, all those concepts together. What would be your sort of takeaway from this book?
Yeah, so I think, the way that I would say it is that, when you read text that is focused at practitioners, whether that is industry research reports, whether that is commentary on, say, a Bloomberg TV or a Financial Times or something like that, or when you read a book that is focused at practitioners, I think that what you will find, I think, is that it will be very focused on that day's narrative, right? Like if something has happened on that particular day or that particular week, right, then that will kind of dominate that story, and understandably so, right? And when you think about the opposite end of that spectrum, if you read an academic textbook on, say, international economics or foreign exchange, it's so far removed from what is going on that it's very hard to see how to apply some of those, let's say, very long shelf life ideas in your practical trading. Where this book sits is that it tries to combine the insights from macroeconomic theory, right? These long shelf life ideas, and it tries to put those in practitioner language so that you can apply them and understand how to apply those ideas to what is going on in the world today. And if you do that in a systematic way, then you can actually make sure that you're consistent, right? Because you apply the same kind of model framework today as you do next year and as you do the year after that, right? And so I think that is kind of what makes this book unique and quite different to other things that you might be able to read, whether through industry reports or academic textbooks. This book sits at sits somewhere in the middle of all of those things.
So just for any of our audience that might be interested in getting the book, can you just give us an idea of sort of the level of mathematics that might be required or understanding of economics? And if you think it would be an appropriate read for sort of an amateur investor looking to get into options or foreign exchange?
So I'd say that for an amateur investor looking to get into options, options trading, I would definitely, naturally recommend my original book, Volatility Practical Options Theory, which is available on Amazon and elsewhere. I think that it is probably, it's probably the most intuitive explanation of options theory that you'll be able to find out there. It is written, I always describe it as, being written almost backwards. It does all of the intuition, the rules of thumb, the heuristics, sort of trader shortcuts and those things before it does any of the complex sort of Black-Scholes-Merton models and so on. And really, I only even did the Black-Scholes-Merton model because I wanted to try and convince the reader that, that this book is rigorous. And so I would definitely recommend that book for amateurs looking to understand options for the first time. Now my new book, Foreign Exchange Practical Asset Pricing and Macroeconomic Theory, that book, I would, the level of mathematics that's required, I would say, is quite low. It uses what you might typically have in, I'm from the UK, and so what we would describe as A-level mathematics, so that, what you learn between the age of 16 and 18 school, basic differentiation, some basic sort of calculating expectations and probability theory. The book also has appendices to remind the readers of these things. But there are also very clear demarcations, right? So you can read the book, you can kind of skip sections that are maybe slightly more technical, and there's many parts of the book that you can kind of read if you're not so inclined that way. But I think the reason that when I wrote this book, I didn't shy away from actually having derivations in it, is because, again, I wanted to convince the reader that this is not hand wavy, right? This is a kind of rigorous explanation, exposition of some of these key ideas. The reason that I like to use at least some level of mathematics in my books is because, if you think about what the maths does, is it takes you from a set of assumptions to a set of logical conclusions that follow from that mathematics, right? And so, you know, there's no way you can get lost in the middle there, right? You either, you know, either your assumptions are wrong. If you don't like your conclusions, your assumptions must be wrong, but there's no kind of middle ground in which to argue. And so I think mathematics really brings a certain level of clarity to the explanation. So I hope that, you know, I hope that the book is accessible to a large number of readers. I think that some of the concepts, if you compare the mathematics that are used in that book to where, you know, the level of mathematics you might have to go through to understand concepts around risk premium in typical financial economics textbooks, I would say that mine is very, very accessible. But yeah, at the same time, it's not zero by any means. One does have to get into some mathematics to really get into the concepts properly.
Well, those are all the questions I have for you. Thank you so much for joining us on the show, Dr. Iqbal.
Thanks for having me.
Perfect. Dr. Iqbal's latest book, Foreign Exchange, Practical Asset Pricing and Macroeconomic Theory, as well as his other book, they're available on Amazon and pretty much everywhere else. It's been a pleasure speaking with you. Thank you, everyone, for listening to the Economics Review. And as always, we'll be back soon with the latest.